So I'm just sitting in this rehab class, trying to get myself unhooked on ass. So then my teacher asked me a question, like, Ludacris, are you over there sexting? Ha ha, OMG, LOL, K-I-S.
This is Alexandra Katahakis, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
So I'm getting treated for my sex addiction in a private clinic, and I need you to be sensitive about my condition.
The following internet radio show is for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
Have you ever asked yourself the question, am I a sex addict? Or if not you, what about your spouse? We have all heard the rumors about celebrities such as Tiger Woods, David Duchovny, Charlie Sheen, and other celebrities who have reportedly attended rehabilitation clinics for treatment of their alleged sex addictions. Many men and women in society use the term sex addict fairly loosely, but experts and licensed therapists in the field of sexual health have performed hours of research and take the study of sex addiction very seriously. There is one such therapist in West Los Angeles who makes it her passion to help both individuals and couples recover from various forms of sex addiction and sexual dysfunction so that they can move forward with their lives and enjoy more healthy relationships and a more responsible sex life. Who is this woman whose career centers on improving men and women's erotic intelligence? Her name is Alexandra Katahakis, and right now you're about to enter into the erotic zone with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, the King of Verbal Seduction. This is the Erotic Conversationalist.
Sex addicts typically will turn to sex for everything. If they're happy, they want to have sex. If they're sad, they want to have sex. If they're angry, if they're stressed out, whatever's going on internally, they turn to sex to make themselves feel better all the time. So you hear guys saying, you know, I really didn't want to have sex with this woman. She was actually even not that attractive, but I did it anyway because I couldn't not do it. They make efforts to stop repeatedly, and they can't stop doing it. When two people are connected, when they can really, you know, make eye contact with one another, when they're feeling each other and they're fucking each other at the same time.
Say it again.
When they're feeling each other and fucking each other.
Ooh, gotta say that again.
And fucking each other.
A little bit louder one more time.
Fucking each other.
You said when they're feeling each other and
fucking each other.
Ooh, I like that.
Okay.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Erotic Conversationalist. I know it's been a little while since my last podcast installment, but I've been very busy, as you know, with my other show, Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. But now I am back, and I'm ready to have another interesting and provocative discussion designed to help you, the listener, out with anything and everything related to your sex life. Tonight's discussion is going to center around sexual addiction. Sexual addiction. Now, you know, this has been in the news most prominently to do with world-famous golfer Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods, of course, everybody knows by now, had some challenges to his marriage that started with Thanksgiving of 2009. And the conclusion was that he was suffering some degree of sex addiction. Now, some people have debated on that. Is he truly a sex addict? Is he not? But I have an expert here today that is going to enlighten us on the symptoms of sex addiction, what exactly sex addiction is, how do you know if you might be suffering from sex addiction, one of your romantic companions or partners might be suffering from some form of sexual addiction. So we're going to get into all the ins and outs of who's a sex addict, how did they get that way, how can they recover from sexual addiction, and hopefully we can teach you a thing or two. My guest for this discussion is the founder and clinical director of the Center for Healthy Sex in West Los Angeles, California. She has lectured for the Eastern Group Psychotherapy Society, Psychotherapy Network, or annual conference. I mean, her resume is very extensive. Mainly what she concentrates on is helping individuals and couples recover from sex addiction, as well as just generally revitalize their sex lives. She's very credentialed. She's been featured on a number of national radio programs, television programs, She's been featured in a number of media publications. So without further ado, I welcome to this episode of The Erotic Conversationalist, Miss Alexandra Katahakis. How are you this evening? Now, can I call you simply Alex?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right, Alex. Now, you heard me in my introduction mention Tiger Woods.
Right.
Now, the brothers, we've just been talking about each other. We like, the dude just loves him some pussy. He just wanted some extra pussy on the side. We don't think he's all some kind of, you know, diagnosed sex addict. Do you, just on your own opinion, what you know about sex addicts, do you think he was just a incorrigible adulterer, or do you think he was a true sex addict?
Well, first of all, I just have to tell you that ethically, I can't diagnose somebody I've never met before, so
okay.
I can only talk to you about him hypothetically, so
okay.
I just want to get that clear right off the bat.
Okay.
You know, and these are big conversations that people are having is, you know, what's what here? Is this thing called sex addiction real, or is it just an excuse for behaving badly? And it's a challenging question to ask, but or to answer, but there are some real criteria for people that are sex addicts. I mean, sex addiction is no joke. You know, it's not something you high-five somebody about. It's not sexy. It's not fun. I mean, typically people that are sex addicts are in a lot of pain. They're leading double lives. They're lying to their family members, often wives and children. They're like this plate spinner. Remember the plate spinners from the old vaudeville days that would run around trying to keep the plates going?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how a lot of sex addicts live their lives, because they're having to keep the lies going and cover the lies up. And they start to feel a lot of craziness and a lot of despair. And they start to have a lot of messes in their lives, meaning problems, as a result of their sexual behavior.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Lies on. So you said they're basically duplicitous people. I guess that would be an understatement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, if we look at any of our, you know, recent political scams that have come out with sexual problems, they've been highly duplicitous. And I just want to be clear, just because somebody has an affair doesn't make them a sex addict. Just because somebody masturbates to porn does not make them a sex addict. Sex addiction is a repeated pattern of behaviors that a person tells themselves they're going to stop and then they can't stop. It creates consequences in their financial life, their personal life, their business life. Oftentimes people lose jobs because of their sexual behavior. So they lose time in addition to all these other things. And, you know, again, they tell themselves repeatedly they're going to stop and they can't in spite of the negative consequences that occur. So not all sex addicts are created equal. Not everybody is a sex addict. But when people say that they have a problem, their lives are in shambles, they can't stop doing what they're doing, they're about to lose everything that has any meaning to them, namely their families and oftentimes their finances, those people have problems. And if sex is not the problem, it's the abuse of sex that becomes the problem.
Okay, define abusive sex.
It's like shopping. You know, there's no problem with shopping, but if somebody abuses shopping, like they're shopping all the time, they're spending money they don't have, they buy stuff, they take it back compulsively, all of a sudden their whole world is organized around shopping, and shopping, it becomes the problem. And likewise with sex. I mean, sex is a beautiful expression that two people have between one another. It can be incredibly fun, pleasurable. I mean, you can hit any number of notes with sex and sexuality, but when a person is using it as their primary coping mechanism to make themselves feel good about themselves, to get validation outside of themselves, to alter their mood, which is oftentimes what people do who are compulsively masturbating, then all of a sudden they become a slave to sex. It's no longer a choice, and any addiction is about the lack of choice.
Okay, I'm going to have to remember that. Any addiction is about lack of choice. Okay, now, let's say you have, I don't know, a guy named Ralph. And Ralph, he just thinks he enjoys sex, but somebody puts the bug in his ear that he might just be a sex addict. Give me 2 to 3 particular symptoms that would make him know whether or not he was either a sex addict or on the verge of becoming a sex addict.
Well, number one, if Ralph couldn't stop his patterns of behaving or using sex in a way that was secretive or shaming or possibly abusive to himself and or another person. So, you know, is Ralph married? Is he single?
Let's say he was single.
Okay, let's say he's single. And let's say, what are his behaviors? What is he doing when you say he's just having sex?
Okay, like he loves, number one, having sex with different partners.
Uh-huh.
And let's say he watches porn at least 3 to 5 times a week. And he masturbates probably at least 4 to 6 times a week. And when he tells his female friend, Lisa, she says, "Ooh, Ralph, I think you're a sex addict."
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lighthearted comment by her, or is that something that's really real? Is he?
It's only real if Ralph feels like his life is unmanageable, like if he's missing business meetings so that he can stay home and masturbate to porn, if he's got multiple women angry at him because he's been lying, if he feels shameful after he engages in those behaviors with those people, if he's losing any kind of time as a result of it.
Okay, I heard you say that before. I guess I generally know what that means, but what do you mean when you say losing time?
Well, I mean, you know, if you get on the internet and you think, oh, I'm just going to check my email for 3 minutes, and the next thing you know, there's 30 minutes has gone by. People that get involved in internet porn, they think they're on for much shorter periods of time than they are. People will lose sleep, and it makes them unable to get up for work in the morning. Then they're exhausted at work during the day. So their life becomes problematic as a result of the behavior. It's like drinking a little bit too much wine and waking up hungover before you go to work the next day. If you do that on occasionally, you know, and you're in your 20s and you can handle it and kind of get through the day, then it's cool. It's all good. But if it starts to become a problem and your performance on the job is failing, we could argue in some ways that you're stealing your employer's money because you're not the person they thought you were when they hired you. You're lying about your competence. You're lying about your ability because you're kind of zoned out, spaced out.
Interesting.
Sex addicts typically will turn to sex for everything. If they're happy, you know, they want to have sex. If they're sad, they want to have sex. If they're angry, if they're stressed out, whatever's going on internally, they turn to sex to make themselves feel better all the time. They don't turn to other people. They don't ask for help and what they need. And so oftentimes it's kind of like being a one-trick pony. So, you know, again, if somebody is experiencing a loss of control, meaning that they are engaging in behaviors where they do more than what they intend to or want to. So you hear guys saying, you know, "I really didn't want to have sex with this woman. She was actually even not that attractive, but I did it anyway because I couldn't not do it." Or, as I said earlier, the behavior is compulsive, where there's a pattern of out-of-control behavior over time. So the person says, "I'm not going to do that anymore," and they do it anyway. And they make efforts to stop repeatedly, and they can't stop doing it. Likewise, yeah, I mean, I also talked about loss of time. So people lose time either in the sexual behavior or recovering from the behavior. Because sex addicts spend an awful lot of time cruising, thinking, fantasizing, kind of getting into the sexual experience. And then once they have the experience, they spend all this time on the back end covering it up. If they're in a relationship or if they're lying or if they leave work. You know, if a guy leaves work in the middle of the day every day to go get sexual massage and his boss wonders where he's going every day, you know, that becomes a compulsive problem where he's losing time, as I said. Then there's also the matter of preoccupation, where the person is obsessing about sex or they're obsessing about the behavior all the time, so it takes up a lot of headspace. And then, you know, they can't fulfill obligations, so behavior interferes with work, school, family, friends. Sex addicts often will keep an open calendar. So, like, if you call me up and say, "Hey, do you want to go to a movie this weekend?" And I say, "Well, you know, let me get back to you. I don't really ever commit to you because if I get a better offer, I'm going to go do that thing instead." Then there's also, as I said, the continuation, even though there are consequences. So somebody might have problems with the law. They might be spending way too much money on strip clubs, prostitutes, or if it's female, maybe she's giving way too much money to the guys that she hooks up with. There might be physical consequences like STDs, things of that nature. And, you know, people keep doing it anyway. And then there's also escalation with sex addicts, just like there is with drug and alcohol. the behavior has to be more intense, more frequent, or more risky. So there's a seeking for a higher high. Ultimately, when somebody stops, there's a problem of withdrawal. They get considerably distressed. There's anxiety, restlessness, depression, irritability. I mean, people that stop their daily compulsive behaviors will go through a withdrawal period.
Interesting. Okay, now let me ask you this. Recently, media mogul Playboy founder Hugh Hefner came out and basically attacked the idea of sex addiction. He basically said, I'm paraphrasing, he said there's essentially no such thing in his mind as sex addiction. Mm-hmm. It's just a lie and an excuse for adultery. What are your thoughts on his comments?
Well, I mean, look, he's the king of porn. What's he going to say about that? And I think in his day, it was less likely that people were having sex as intensely as they are now, or that's not fair. It wasn't as accessible as it is now, because most of our kids today are getting their sex education from online pornography, and that's really a pretty intense thing to think about. When you know what kind of images are online, there's some really intensely violent images against women today, which, you know, seem to be on the rise. There's hardcore stuff that, you know, would make Larry Flint's hair curl. And that's what children are looking at, you know, when they're 13 years old, 14 years old. So these set profoundly powerful arousal templates in the brain. You know, and we know from the gaming business that people get hooked on gaming because the reward center of the brain naturally goes after the desire to complete a task. It's how humans are wired. And so likewise, I think people get attracted to online pornography in a way that's beyond what they maybe started out doing. They just keep wanting to do it over and over and over again. So they're ringing the bell so that it's the next higher high. They can't stop doing it. They wish they weren't doing it. They feel bad about themselves. That didn't exist in Hugh Hefner's early days. He probably never had to look at an online anything because he'd always had hot and cold running women.
Yeah.
That's why you have people, you know, who are, you know, incredibly smart and intelligent in our country doing some stupendously dumb things. I mean, we've seen this with our politicians the last year. You know, we saw it with Elliot Spitzer. We saw it with Senator Craig in the bathroom with that guy he was hooking up with.
Mm-hmm.
There was just a guy in Miami. Did you hear about this? He's a conservative Republican who's anti-gay.
Okay.
He went up to Spain with some gay guy and was accused of having sex with him, and he vehemently, denies it, but there's a lot of evidence that points at it.
Wow.
Yeah, he hooked up with a gay escort. His name was George Allen Rekers, R-E-K-E-R-S.
Okay, I think I remember hearing about that.
Okay, so he hired this escort from rentaboy.com, and he's a Baptist minister.
Yeah. Like a
rentaboy. Right. Rentaboy.com. He's a Baptist minister and a psychology professor, and he's all into anti-gay groups. He founded the Family Research Council. And, you know, he's calling the report slanderous, saying that he just needed the guy to lift his luggage during his travels because he had a problem. And, you know, this is like when Ted Haggard was caught having, you know, sex with a prostitute, a male prostitute, and smoking crack.
Mm.
And he was an evangelical minister. So these are the kind of problems that we're talking about. When people purport to be one thing and they're really something else. And, you know, what goes with that then are losses. Like I said, people lose, they limit, they sacrifice valued parts of themselves, their communities, their relationships, their lives. I mean, this guy is this prominent anti-gay leader, and he just risked his entire professional reputation with Rent-A-Boy.
Did you ever see the movie 9½ Weeks?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking now, would you say that Mickey Rourke's character was possibly, because a lot of things you mentioned make me think him, because in his relationship in the movie with Kim Basinger, they start off seeming, you know, just very normal. Didn't seem like every time they had sex, it kind of escalated to a scenario that was that much more riskier and that much more kinkier.
Right.
To the point that by the end of the movie, he brought in another woman and she couldn't handle it, and they kind of reached a point of no return, at least for her.
Right.
Would you say he was at least borderline sex addict?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example of sex addiction, a snapshot of it, because, you know, in my thinking, what two people do between themselves, consensual adults, is really up to them. And there's a distinction, I think, between sex that's relational and connected versus that which is just strictly pornographic and about getting off. And so if you're just hooking up with someone who's anonymous, or it's just casual and it's about the high and it's about the dopamine rush and it's about getting off, I mean, that's fine occasionally. But if it's an ongoing steady stream, that person likely cannot be in a relationship. That's what we call intimacy phobic or relationship phobic. When two people are connected, when they can really, you know, make eye contact with one another, when they're feeling each other and they're fucking each other at the same time.
Say it again.
Say All right, so I said right, when they're feeling each other and fucking each other.
Ooh, gotta say that again.
Sure, and fucking each other.
A little bit louder one more time.
Okay, feeling each other and fucking each other. Is that better?
You said when they're feeling each other and...
fucking each other.
Ooh, I like that.
Okay. So I guess this is an example of how you work your power as the king of verbal seduction.
Alex, you know I'm about to have you say that one more time.
Okay. The king of verbal seduction, right?
All right. That's one of my regular things. Whenever a woman says something really kinky and erotic or sexual,
uh-huh.
Say it again. You have absolutely the wrong voice to be in the line of work you do.
Why is that?
You have a voice that where someone like me would be trying to gain insight and enlightenment, but mm-hmm. Your voice has a way of getting a guy's dick hard.
Well, I think that works to my advantage, because if I can seduce people into reclaiming their sexuality and getting their lives together and being happy, then that's fine with me.
You're good.
All right, so what was I saying? Oh, I was saying that when two people are having sex and they're feeling each other and fucking each other, then that's a different level of eroticism than when people are just hooking up with one person after another. It's just about getting off, because the getting off over a while can become antithetical to intimacy. And oftentimes those people who are just on that track can't ever get into a relationship. And that's fine if they don't want a relationship. But for people who do, when they keep running these patterns over and over again, they're going to have problems over time. And later in life, that starts looking like, you know, sexual dysfunction or problems of sexual desire.
Now, I often feel like a stereotype of sex addicts, honestly. I think my gender almost gets the unfair stereotype. I think if you'd ask the average person who's more of a sex addict, they would say 90% of sex addicts are men. Are women just as guilty of being sex addicts as men are?
Well, I mean, the statistics are showing now that more and more women are online, and that something like 80% of women that hook up online actually meet their sexual partners in person, which is kind of scary when you think about how dangerous that can be for females. But so we know that there are more females now than ever that are involved in acting out sexually to the degree that it's harming them. So we don't hear about it that much, because I think with men, you know, it's easier to say, well, you know, if a guy's having lots of indiscriminate sex, or if he's sort of serially monogamous but always having an affair or something, then historically in our culture, it's just been that, well, that's what men do. But when it comes to women, I mean, women get called all kinds of names. You know, they're sluts or they're whores or something like that. But right now, there's, I think the latest statistic is that 10% of the adult population in the U.S. are estimated to be sexually addicted to the Internet. And 28% of them are women. And there's something like 70% of women who are using cybersex activities keep their activity secret. They think 17% of women struggle with pornography addiction. Women favor chat rooms over men. They say 1 in 3 visitors to adult websites are female. And about 9.4 million females access adult websites each month.
Wow.
13% of them access pornography at work.
Wow.
And women are far more likely than men to actually act out their sexual behaviors in real life, like having multiple affairs or partners, rather, or casual sex, stuff like that.
Interesting. So not only have men, the nerdy man at work, accessing bigtits.com, but you got the woman. Where access in bigdicks.com.
And something like that, yeah. And then those women are also in the chat room, so they're looking for hookups with men.
Now, you mentioned porn. Do you think that a man or woman can watch porn regularly and still have, I guess, what most would consider, someone like you would consider, a healthy sex life? Or do you think it's almost inevitable that watching too much porn leads to various forms of sex addiction?
I think it's inevitable that watching various forms of porn over and over again is going to lead to either sex addiction or sexual dysfunction. Because the brain can only take so much, and if two people are having sex, or what you would call fucking, and they're watching porn, they're not really watching each other. And what happens when you take that level of stimulus away from the brain? You're going to have a lower level of intensity, and the brain loves novelty. The brain seeks novelty all the time. That's where the dopamine high comes from, and that's where the arousal comes from first. I mean, we all know that the brain is the biggest sex organ there is. So there's something called neuronal fatigue.
Wait, you're telling me my brain is bigger than my dick?
Yeah, it is. It probably weighs more also.
Wow. Okay, go ahead.
So the neurons get tired. There's something called neuronal fatigue. And they start to get tired with that kind of stimulation coming at it, at the brain over and over and over again. And if somebody's looking at porn on the internet, they're looking at pixel screens over and over again, and they're ejaculating or orgasming. You know, after human beings come, they produce a hormone called oxytocin, which is the attachment hormone, and it binds us to the person that we're with.
Wait a minute, is that, that's both genders? I always heard that was just women. You said men and
women? Men release something called vasopressin, but men also release oxytocin when women kiss them.
Really?
So we have these attachment hormones that bind us after orgasm, and I think a lot of guys are getting bound to and attached to their computer screen.
Wow, that's an intimidating thought.
Yeah, it is, but... You know, and then what happens is they get with a real woman and she doesn't look anything like the women in the, you know, the pictures over and over again, and it makes it harder to get aroused.
Now, I don't know how big a movie buff you are. I already threw out 9.5 weeks. Have you ever heard of this movie called Love, Sex, and Eating the Bone?
No.
No, okay. Well, if you got some free time sometime in the next few months, Alex, you might want to watch that. It's,
is it a new movie or is it old?
This is kind of old.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the guy who plays the lead has actually been on my show twice, my other show, Up Front and Straightforward. His name is Hill Harper,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if you're familiar with him, but if you ever watched CSI New York,
right.
He's the most prominent black character on CSI New York.
I see.
And he made this movie, a very good movie. It's both, it's kind of a romantic comedy, but it, to me it has so many real moments from the male perspective particularly. Because basically, in a nutshell, it's about a guy who lives kind of basic life. I think he's like a security guy or something. He meets this woman who's like his dream woman. But his one flaw is he's addicted to porn, and his dick can only get hard when he watches porn.
Right.
So anytime he's about to have sex with his dream woman, he goes into another room and watches porn. And of course,
yeah.
He has all his problems with her, and it's just very interesting. And from what I hear from different conversations, I'm sure there are a number of men who actually experienced that in real life.
Yeah, I mean, I've met them, and they're in a lot of pain about it at a certain point. By the time those guys get to be 45, 47, and they've never been in a long-term relationship, it's pretty sad because they don't know how to get that arousal by looking into someone's eyes, by making themselves vulnerable. They're so avoidant, and their brains now, their arousal template is so geared towards those images. It becomes, you know, it's kind of like the rat with the cocaine lever. It just hits it over and over again until it dies.
Wow. Now, I have to lightheartedly confess, Alex, you know, I've had what I've often felt was my own form of sex addiction, and that would be voices. I'm like a major voice addict. But
right, but it almost sounds like a form of voyeurism.
That, you know, that's what I've often nicknamed it, verbal voyeurism.
Mm-hmm. Or auditory voyeurism.
Oh, so there is like little formal terms for...
Oh, yeah, I just made that up.
The
arousal part of the brain is very close to the auditory canal. And it's interesting because typically women are aroused by that which is whispered in their ear, whereas men are more aroused by what they see. Men like to look.
Yeah.
Women want to hear how it is. And so it's interesting that the voice is more arousing to you, or maybe not more, but it is an arousal point for you. You know, sexually charged fantasies, you know, those, the arousal always depends on sexual possibility. It's not the actuality. And so, you know, fantasy sex addicts are like the number one type of sex addict. They're people that don't necessarily get involved with other people. They don't care that much about the physical contact, but it's all about, it all happens in their head. It all happens in this kind of make-believe world. It's not the world of day-to-day relating, day-to-day living, day-to-day kind of hammering it out with someone. Because the most challenging thing is to be in a long-term relationship with somebody and to keep the eroticism going. And a lot of people can't do that. That's why we have a 50% divorce rate. You know, there's also something called seductive role sex, which is all about the seduction of partners and arousal based on the conquest, and that diminishes rapidly after the initial contact's made with someone.
Tell my listeners again, what is the title of your new book?
It's called Erotic Intelligence, Igniting Hot, Healthy Sex While in Recovery from Sex Addiction.
And what are the four cornerstones of revitalizing your sex life in a relationship?
Well, of intimacy specifically.
The first one
is self-knowledge, and that means that people get really clear about what's true for them sexually, even when it's not comfortable. And, you know, they make a space for themselves and their partner, and they just tell them what they really want and what they really like sexually. Because a lot of sex addicts will act out what they like sexually with other partners, but they don't do it to the person or with the person they're married to because they have too much shame about it, or they think their partner's too uptight or won't want to do it, and sometimes their partners are. So being able to take a stand in a way for who you are sexually is essential to create intimacy and to create hot sex. The second one is comfort and connection. And that means that you develop the capacity to really comfort your anxieties and connect with the other person without reacting to your partner's feelings. And a lot of people have anxiety about sex. If somebody tells them they want to try something sexually and it makes them uncomfortable, you know, they can blame their partner or shame them or make it out to be perverted or weird instead of really calming themselves down and asking themselves why they're getting so uncomfortable in the conversation. The third one is about taking responsibility for oneself, but being discerning while they do that. And that means that a person is assertive. They again, speak up for themselves, what they want, but take responsibility for their actions and tell the truth, even though it's difficult for their partner to hear. So it's not about being mean or controlling or nasty. It's just about being honest and saying, look, you might not like this, but this is what I'm really into, and I've got to tell you because it's important to me. And then finally, the last one is about having empathy with emotion. So people use their emotional...
Okay.
Yeah. People use their emotional ability to recognize and feel the other person's thoughts, moods, feelings. So really taking your partner into consideration and what they might be going through or why they might be scared or uncomfortable.
Now, what I found interesting, Alex, I did a, this was years ago, the Discovery Channel had a special on sex. I can't remember the exact title of it. I ended up being a part of this. I was actually one of a few single people. It was mainly centered on couples and married couples. But what I found most interesting, and you've already alluded to it, was how many couples, I'm talking about couples that have been together for a few years, married couples, they were so scared to talk with their partner openly and straightforwardly about their sexual desires, interests, preferences. Is that something from your work you found to be pretty prevalent?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what drives a lot of people out of their relationships. It's really, it's quite bizarre, actually. I mean, the amount of people that, I mean, people are so afraid and they have so much sexual shame. And that's a big part of what's going on in our culture, too, is that we have this hypersexual world with all this pornography and internet sex and sex available everywhere, but we don't really educate our children about sex in a healthy way. And so people take their sexuality and they shove it underground, but they're really ashamed to tell their partners who they are connected to and close to what they want, because that's about really getting naked and really revealing yourself to another person. And a lot of people are dissatisfied in their relationship. A lot of people don't kiss during sex. I mean, somebody did a study with 14,000 people, and they were asked how their sex life is, and 15% said sex is dead. 34% sex was comatose and in danger of dying. 28% said sex was asleep and needed a wake-up call. And only 15% said sex was alive and well.
Wow.
8% said sex was robust, erotic, and passionate. So 77% of people say that their sex life stinks, basically.
Wow.
That's what the normal is.
Okay, now let me ask you this. I talked to, this was actually a few years ago too, but I talked to this woman who I was working with. And we were talking about different things. And she was telling me about her best friend was married to this guy. And I guess their sex life had become just very stale. They were actually on their way to getting divorced. But then, lo and behold, they start experimenting with couple swapping and swinging. And mm-hmm. she said within a year after that, they had so much passion in their relationship. Now, of course, a lot of people conventionally would think that something like that would destroy a relationship. What are some of your thoughts based on your experience and observation about polyamorous dating, swinging, couple swapping, open marriages? Can that enhance a relationship?
Yeah. I mean, it works for some people and it wouldn't work for others. So it really depends on the people. I mean, there are polyamorous relationships, but the people that I've talked to that engage in them say it's a hell of a lot of work. I mean, the scheduling can be a nightmare, and people are always having to process their feelings and what's going on, and it can be really, really tricky for people. It can be a lot of work, but those people that say it's a lot of work also say it's really gratifying because there's always creating a novelty, and so the arousal is much higher because of the novelty. Because really, sex is about altering brain chemicals and mood all the time. So if somebody else wants your partner, they're going to look more arousing to you than you seeing them every day in a certain light.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned masturbation a few times.
Uh-huh.
And is there any, can you be like a masturbationaholic? Can you actually masturbate too much?
Yeah, I mean, there are people that compulsively masturbate. They masturbate to the point of injury.
Wow, are you kidding me?
Yeah, I'm not kidding you. I mean,
injury?
They masturbate until their penis is raw, or women will use vibrators and they start to burn their clitoris.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a highly compulsive problem. See, that's when it's no longer sexy, cool, or fun. It's when it starts to become painful that we cross over into the world of compulsion and addiction.
Wow, that's you're enlightening me.
So you've never masturbated to the point of injury, is what you're saying?
No, I don't think I've even come close to injuring my dick.
Okay,
but
there are people who do. Yeah.
Wow, that's
raw and it hurts, right?
This kind of relates to swinging. Is a major form of sex addiction either voyeurism, exhibitionism, or a combination of the two?
That's not a major form, but that is a form that we see. Voyeurism and exhibitionism are what we call offending behavior. They're nonviolent sex offenders, people who engage in that behavior, because you are, you know, offending somebody whose permission you don't have. Exhibitionists will typically expose themselves to women. And it's usually an act of violence because it typically scares women or freaks them out. And you don't see women exposing themselves to men. And if you do, the men aren't going to call the cops. See how they do that? No, really, have you ever known a guy who called the cops because a woman flashed her butt at him? No.
That's funny, Alex. That's the best humor you've ever Oh, man. I would pretty much bet my money that a man's not going to call the cops.
That's right. But if it happens the other way around, women will call the cops on a man in a heartbeat, and those guys will be arrested for lewd conduct or something like that. And just like the voyeurs also, I mean, looking when somebody doesn't know you're looking, it's different if, you know, both people are looking and they know they're looking and they're playing a game with each other. But if it's happening and the person who's being looked at doesn't know it, it's offending. And, you know, that's also a an arrestable behavior.
Wow. Interesting. Okay, only got a couple more questions for you. One would be, what if you have a man or a woman, I guess, shying away from relationships, and they are having quite a bit of casual sex, which I guess on paper is not necessarily a big deal. But what if the man is frequently having unprotected sex, knowing he can get a number of women pregnant or receive an STD, or a woman is doing the same
or transmit
thing.
One to a woman.
Transmit one to a woman.
Carriers, yeah.
Or a woman is exhibiting the same type of behavior. Would that be a symptom of sex addiction, or would that just be irresponsible sex?
Well, that's completely irresponsible sex, and that's not an earmark of sex addiction. It would just depend, again, on all those other criteria that I gave you. But that's just, it's irresponsible, and it's cruel. And that's why it's important for people to take responsibility for their own birth control, sexual protection, etc.
Now, your book, Erotic Intelligence. You base now this book centers on, I'm assuming, someone who, okay, Erotic Intelligence, Igniting Hot, Healthy Sex While in Recovery from Sex Addiction.
Right.
That would be my final question. Say you have, okay, let's use me. I'm the bona fide sex addict. Alex has told me that, Alan, you're just on some kind of erotic power trip. You like to break women down and get them to play with their pussies.
You should go to a 12-step meeting. You should go to a Sex Addicts Anonymous meeting. And you should probably go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And
wow.
Sit there and listen. Yeah, it's three.
Come on, Alex, that's cold. See, you that's cold. You said
no, it's not.
90 meetings in 90 days.
Right. It's free. It's a self-help program. And you can get the help you need there to stop the behaviors you're engaging in that are making you feel bad about yourself.
Alex, on a real tip, I never feel bad.
Well, then.
Like I'm a sex addict.
Yeah, if you don't feel bad about it, then there's no problem. With
okay,
people,
but we're still going under this hypothetical. Okay, say, go on with your recovery plan for me.
Okay, and then I would tell you also the third thing I would tell you would be to, you know, stop having sex for 30 or 60 days. Like no masturbation, no sex, no nothing. So that we could take a look at what's going on with you, how anxious you are, how depressed you are, to see if there are any real withdrawal symptoms.
You know,
sex addicts.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Typically, well, one of the things sex addicts think is that sex is their most important need, and they quickly learn that it's not.
That, you know, I have to be honest. When you just said that, that would be a challenge for me. On a personal level, I've gone actually definitely more than 30, even 60 days without sex, physical sex.
Uh-huh.
But masturbation, never. I think the most I've ever gone in my life is maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks.
Right.
So 30 days, that would be wow. So
yeah,
if I was for 30 days, someone like you would just kind of have me maybe like keep a journal and see how I'm responding to that.
Yeah, well, I have my clients check in with me and let me know how they're doing during the course of the week. Because that tells me what's going on in terms of their mood. And a lot of people that have this problem have mood disorders.
Now, what would Alex say is the difference? I was watching one time an episode of Real Sex, and they asked a question to these people. What was their distinction between being sexual and erotic? And so I'm going to ask you, I'm going to throw one more word in there. What would you say is the difference between being sexual, erotic, and intimate?
Well, I think sexual deals, you know, is defined as, you know, anything that has to do with, I think, is about the act, and sexuality is about a person's capacity for sex. And I think, you know, exploring a person's sexual identity is important, and it comes through the rules and culture that a person grows up in and the culture we live in today. Like, our culture really informs sex and sexuality. And I think that sex is also about knowing the functions of sexual anatomy for both genders, accepting one's body without shame, and integrating masturbation, fantasy, focusing on positive sexuality, things of that nature.
Wait, slow down. What was that?
Okay. Sex And sexual health kind of covers all of those things, or it involves those things. And I think that healthy sex is not abusive in any way, and also that it's not secretive or shameful to yourself or the person that you're with. I think it's also not used to ignore or escape your feelings, which a lot of people use sex as a way to get out of their feelings, the way they use drugs or alcohol. And I also think that healthy sex is about love, respect, mutual caring, giving, receiving pleasure, and that there's a connection with people that are having healthy sexual relationships with one another. Now, eroticism, I mean, the word erotic means something like the deliberate seeking of pleasure. And I don't think I remember exactly what you were saying. Well, the difference between sex or sexuality, eroticism and intimacy, right?
Yeah, I was saying the difference between being sexual, erotic, and intimate.
Mm-hmm. So I think if we just go back to the word intimate, I mean, intimacy is really about making a connection with somebody. It's about an unbelievable closeness that people find with one another. And it's typically found between two people. So people use the word intimacy as a euphemism for sex, but I don't really see it that way. I think intimacy comes when you risk talking to your partner about what your sexual preferences are, about your anxiety about sex, about what's uncomfortable, what's scary, what's novel, and really giving voice to what's true to you sexually. And when two people can talk about that, there's an eroticism that builds out of that kind of honesty. So being able to listen, being able to hear what your partner's saying, and connecting with them from a heart space is what I think intimacy is. And if we're talking about in a committed relationship, I talk about this in my book, Erotic Intelligence, that I created four cornerstones of intimacy that I think are really sort of the bedrock for having a long-term, healthy, intimate, erotic sex life with somebody.
They're depressed, they're anxious, they use orgasm to keep the loneliness away. They don't really know how to be intimate with people.
Okay. Well, you have provided much knowledge and wisdom and expertise to my listeners and myself. I was watching your videos. I got to pick up your book because, yeah, I think I might learn some things from your book.
Good. All right. Well, give me a call if you come to L.A. Come by my office and say hello.
Alex, I'm going to have to make your acquaintance. You're in West Los Angeles?
Yeah.
What's the nearest major intersection you're near?
I'm between Roxbury and Century Park East, so it's South Beverly Hills, but it's not quite West L.A.
Okay.
I mean, it is West L.A., but it's on the east part of West L.A. It's closer to Beverly Hills than anything.
I thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This episode of The Erotic Conversationalist was produced by Alan Roger Curry for Mode One Multimedia Incorporated.